lady, my guide, Melissa Higgins, said as she took me through the house. Midland in the 50s was an unpolished, hard-drinking boom town. The Bushes arrived as a powerful civilizing force. They raised money to build a theater, a YMCA, and a symphony. Barbara was the den mother for the Cub Scouts. George taught Sunday school and coached Little League. There were enough other Ivy Leaguers also seeking their fortunes in West Texas that Bush started a branch of the Yale Club. In 1953, together with the brothers Hugh and Bill Liedtke, he formed an oil exploration company he called Zapata after Marlon Brando's movie Viva Zapata came out. They drilled 127 wells in West Texas without a single dry hole. The walls of the Bush house are knotty pine, giving it the feel of a lake cottage. The tiny living room has a built-in seat in the bay window and a television of the era, with a rabbit ears antenna. There is a fireplace in the dining room. George W.'s room has a fold-out desk attached to a bookcase, built to replicate the one that had been there when he was a boy. There's a train set, a Cub Scout uniform draped across the bed, and a picture of little George riding a jackalope. Above the bed is a poster of Roy Rogers, King of the Cowboys, atop his gorgeous Palomino mount, Trigger. My guide told me that George and his friends carried a copy of the Roy Rogers Riders Club rules in their wallets. "Be neat and clean," Roy advises. "Protect the weak and help them. Eat all your food and never waste any." There are 10 altogether. Roy was prim and modest, with a smooth tenor voice, the kind of role model parents adore. But there was another force stirring the universe at the same time, darker and sexier, not at all wholesome. For boys our age, Roy Rogers was the anti-Elvis. I'm a year younger than George W., and Roy Rogers was a big figure in my life as well. I had a Roy Rogers cap gun, which I recently saw listed on eBay for $1,000. There is a single bathroom with a tub, no shower, and a master bedroom in the corner with a view of the large fenced backyard and doghouse. The kitchen has a window over the sink, a gas stove, and what would have been an extravagance at the time, a washer and dryer. A small sunroom with clapboard walls became Jeb's nursery when he was born in 1953. The third bedroom has no door on it. The Bushes took it off when their daughter, Robin, was diagnosed with leukemia in 1954. It took her 7 months to die. "That's when Mrs. Bush's hair turned white," Melissa told me. "She colored it for many years and then finally gave up." Barbara Bush was 28 years old. She later recounted that the only thing that pulled her out of her prolonged depression was hearing George W. tell a friend that he couldn't play because "I have to take care of my mother." Like many Texans, I harbor a fondness for the Bush family that has nothing to do with their politics. Numberless people in the state can testify to their kindness and decency. Laura Bush was a librarian at a public school in Austin. As First Lady of the state, she started the Texas Book Festival, which has been a boon to the state's libraries. Later, she also began the National Book Festival in Washington, D.C. Our daughter, Caroline, went to Austin High School with George and Laura's twins, Jenna and Barbara, when their father was governor. We used to go to the Christmas party at the governor's mansion each year, and the governor always asked Caroline to dance. He really liked to boogie. His shirt would get so sweaty you could see his body hair. "I don't drink or do drugs," he told me, "so I got to do something to get it out of my system." Texas was still in transition from its days of being overwhelmingly Democratic to being solidly Republican, two eras bookended by LBJ and George W. In each case, the metamorphosis of Texas politics would profoundly change the nation. When Bush was governor, between 1995 and 2000, a cordial détente existed between the parties. The lieutenant governor, Bob Bullock, and Pete Laney, the Speaker of the House, were both Democrats, and they became exhibits in Bush's argument that he would be a bipartisan president. Bullock was a titanic figure whose ruinous personal life, alcoholism, cancer, chronic depression, five marriages, only added to his legend. He reminded me of Lyndon Johnson, with the same huge, battered face and an unbridled love of Texas that allowed him to see over the barriers of party loyalties. At Bush's 50th birthday party at the governor's mansion in July 1996, Bullock offered a toast to the governor as the next president of the United States. As far as I know, that was the first time such a statement had been made in public, and it was made by the highest Democratic official in the state. That same year, Bush launched a new statewide reading initiative at the school where Roberta was teaching, Travis Heights Elementary, and the principal chose to stage the press event in Roberta's classroom. Roberta taught a mixed kindergarten first grade and second grade class, and she agreed reluctantly, since the event was scheduled to take place at nap time. She picked out some of her best readers to sit on the governor's lap. But when the news crews and reporters trooped in, one of her troublemakers, Ricky Hernandez, impish and adorable, crept through the crowd and caught Bush's eye. "Hey, Podnuck, hop on up," Bush said, and Ricky, who couldn't read a lick, crawled into the governor's lap. Bush read, "There's a ghost in the boys' bathroom," as Ricky beamed, and of course that was the picture on the front pages of the newspapers the next morning. What wasn't reported was that later that afternoon, Roberta had to send Ricky home because he had head lice. In 1998, I was asked to read at a fundraising event for literacy that the former First Lady, Barbara Bush, puts on in Houston each year. A well-known writer, Stephen Ambrose, had fallen ill, and they needed a substitute tomorrow. Would I mind flying down with the governor? I wouldn't mind. I went over to the mansion the next afternoon and found the governor noshing pound cake in the kitchen. He was cheery and familiar. He always seemed a much more natural politician than his father, and totally at ease, like a gifted athlete who didn't feel the need to train. "Has Dad left yet?" the governor asked his mother on the phone before we left. "I need a hat. Tell him to bring several." We flew on George W.'s personal plane, a King Air turboprop that Laura described as perfect for Texas. By now, I and everyone else were sizing him up as a future president. He seemed unfazed by the challenge ahead of him. He picked up the Dallas Morning News from the pile of newspapers on the seat in front of him, glanced at it, then set it down. We chatted a bit about the Middle East. I had just been in Jerusalem, and I told him about the rift between American Jews and the Orthodox rabbinate in Israel, which had declared that the Reform and conservative branches of the faith were not true Jews. Bush was unaware of the issue, but observed, "They better be careful they don't cut off their money base." I was struck by how little he knew about the region, or any place really outside of Texas. I often wondered how the son of a former president, who had also been ambassador to the United Nations and envoy to China, as well as director of the CIA, could be so unacquainted with the wider world. I inquired about a recent visit the governor had with a Russian strongman, Alexander Lebed. Bush had been amused by the Russian's fierce demeanor, which he said quickly melted away. "I always ask them about their families," which apparently did the trick. George W.'s complacency and his absence of curiosity, traits that would come to define him and doom him, were already apparent on that airplane ride. At the fundraiser, I was wedged into the program among the writers who were household names, and because I didn't have a recent book to promote, I read an article I had written about Caroline's doll, whom she named Nephew. He was a ratty little cloth doll of a type called Monchichis, made to look like some kind of diabolical lower primate. Nephew came into Caroline's possession when she was 4. She was always telling me stories of his travels to China or Dallas and his many wives. I felt like the Sultan Shahryar listening to the tales of Scheherazade. But then Caroline would throw Nephew over a balcony and imitate his screams as he fell to the street. When Caroline turned 5, Barbie came into her life, and Nephew got sidelined. Finally, she gave the doll to me. "You're the only one who loves him now," she said. A few days after the reading, I got a letter from the former president, which I suspect was typical of the thousands he wrote every year. He had typed it himself with several emendations scribbled in the margins. Last night, Barbara and I got to talking about Nephew, engaging fellow that he obviously is. But did you know that George and Laura's daughter, Barbara, has a nephew-like icon named Spikey? Once Spikey got lost in the VP house, a crisis, much like the tanks rolling through the streets of Budapest, narrowly averted when Spikey was found hidden under a living room couch. Just 10 days ago, Spikey, still in tow, went to Italy with the twins and Barbara. Too bad Nephew couldn't make it. A year later, as the presidential primaries were about to begin, I ran into Laura at Antone's, the Austin Blues Club. Marcia Ball was playing. Laura was in the company of friends, drinking and smoking, which you never saw her do. It was a sweet moment, but I immediately thought how this intimate little community we all lived in was about to end. Soon the cameras would roll into town, reporters would be knocking over gravestones, and everything in our culture would be scrutinized and dissected. I had been a part of that process many times. Like it or not, we would be on stage. We would be reviewed. Some of us would become famous beyond our circle, and others would be indicted. Bush father and son provide a riveting field of study for anyone interested in Oedipal dramas. George W. went to the same schools, first Andover and then Yale, where the father had become a Phi Beta Kappa and the son became president of his fraternity. George W. did, however, go to Harvard Business School. Like his father, the son was a naval pilot, but whereas the father earned a Distinguished Flying Cross while serving in the Pacific Theater during the Second World War, the son served in the Texas Air National Guard, which was a well-known refuge from the Vietnam War for privileged sons of prominent men and players for the Dallas Cowboys. Both Bushes became oil men in Midland, where the father was a legend and the son broke even. George H.W. was a graceful athlete. He had been scouted by major league teams when he played first base for Yale, and in Midland he used to dazzle the boys he coached by catching fly balls behind his back. George W. was a gym rat who would boast that in his first term as president, he had actually gained muscle mass. By becoming a partial owner of the Texas Rangers, the son eclipsed his father's baseball career, as he did as president when he was reelected to a second term in office. Both men would invade Iraq, the first time for good reasons and the second time for a lie sold to the American people, which would cause enduring damage to our country and set fire to the Middle East. Neither man was the least bit self-reflective, a quality they seemed to think weak and pointless. "I don't brood," George W. said dismissively. Despite their Ivy League educations, each of them had a tendency to wander off into linguistic labyrinths that generated much discussion in psychiatric literature. When he was running for president the first time, George H.W. boasted about his close relationship to Ronald Reagan. "I have worked alongside him, and I am proud to be his partner. We have had triumphs. We have made mistakes. We have had sex." There was a startled gasp in the audience as Bush regrouped. "We have had setbacks," he corrected. When he was running for re-election, he remarked, "Somebody said, 'We pray for you over there.' That was not just because I threw up on the Prime Minister of Japan, either. Where was he when I needed him? But I said, 'Let me tell you something.' And I say this, I don't know whether any ministers from the Episcopal Church are here, I hope so. But I said to him this, 'You're on to something here. You cannot be President of the United States if you don't have faith. Remember Lincoln, going to his knees in times of trial and the Civil War and all that stuff? You can't be, and we are blessed. So don't feel sorry for... Don't cry for me, Argentina.'" Newsweek began calling him the mysterious Easterner. Bushspeak, as it became known, was taken to a new level by the son, who sometimes seemed to be totally unaware of the words marching out of his mouth. "More and more of our imports come from overseas," he observed. On education, rarely is the question asked, "Is our children learning?" On the eve of the election, he remarked, "They misunderestimated me." W. actually made fun of his predilection for nonsensical utterance. "Now, most people would say, in speaking of the economy, we ought to make the pie bigger. He confessed at the annual Radio and Television Correspondents Association dinner in Washington soon after he took office. "I, however, am on record saying we ought to make the pie higher." It was a very complicated economic point I was trying to make. He was so easy to like in the early days. Bush was a good governor, not corrupt, a centrist by Texas standards. He had even tried to raise taxes on business in order to meet the growing social needs of the state. That was heresy in the Republican Party and went nowhere. But at least he acknowledged the disparities that made Texas so cold-hearted to its less fortunate citizens. He might have waited through another election cycle before he ran to gain more experience, but he told his friends he felt like a cork in a river, and he simply surrendered to the flow. Part of his drive seemed to be a deep dislike of the eventual Democratic candidate, Al Gore, the kind of guy you always wanted to punch out in high school, Bush told me at a Christmas gathering in 1998 before running off to church. "I'll pray for you," he said as he playfully grabbed me by the neck. "I'll pray for myself, too." Everything nearly came to an ignominious end for Bush in November 1999, as the presidential race was underway. The governor was jogging around Lady Bird Lake, trailed by his bodyguard, Roscoe Huey, a state trooper, on a bicycle. Suddenly, a waste disposal truck, which was carrying a trailer full of construction debris, careened out of control. Bush saw the trailer just as it began to tip over. He instinctively dove under a bridge culvert, getting scraped and bruised as the trailer dumped debris on top of his bodyguard. I later asked Bush about the incident, wondering if he had done something to piss off the garbage workers. He laughed, but it really was a close call. "Roscoe's eyes were rolling back in his head," he told me. I said, "Roscoe, what's my name? What's my name?" Fortunately, he got it right the first time. In the 2000 primaries, W. lost to John McCain in New Hampshire by 17 points, nearly torpedoing his campaign. 12 years before, in the same Republican primaries, George H.W. had carried the entire East Coast. "My father is not a Texan," the governor explained. He said that immediately after New Hampshire, he had been talking to his chief strategist, Carl Rove, about how to recover, and then, when Rove left, Laura said that she had 2 points she wanted to make. One, Texans don't win in the East. The second point was about McCain. "You let him talk down to you." Bush seemed amazed by her insight. This was a librarian from Midland, Texas, telling me this. On election day, I watched returns with friends in Dallas. During cocktails, Florida was declared for Democratic nominee Al Gore, and we went to dinner, certain that the election was over. By the time I got to my hotel room, Florida had flipped to Bush. I awakened at 5 a.m. and turned on the TV. Gore was now winning both the popular vote and the electoral vote, with Florida and Oregon still outstanding. This was only a couple of hours after networks had declared Florida for Bush, and Gore had called him to concede, then called back 20 minutes later to withdraw his concession. Bush began that morning with 246 electoral votes, compared to 259 for Gore. Florida's 25 electoral votes would decide the issue. Bush was 1,784 votes ahead in the state, out of 5.8 million that had been cast. Rich Oppel, the editor of the Austin American-Statesman, told me he had stopped the presses twice during the night before finally going with the headline, "History on Hold." The night after the election, I was the master of ceremonies at the Texas Book Festival Gala, and there was a reception at the governor's mansion. Laura greeted us at the door and seemed relieved to have the opportunity to just chat about our children. Condoleezza Rice, the future national security advisor and secretary of state, was there, and I took the opportunity to ask if she thought the election stalemate posed a security problem. "Not at this point," she said. "Right now, I think most other countries are just looking at us with amusement." Dick Cheney, who was then still scouting potential vice presidents other than himself, sat alone in an anteroom, gripping a drink and looking bewildered. Rick Perry, the recently elected lieutenant governor, stood in the foyer, obviously wondering which new office he was going to hold. The governor finally arrived, agitated and exhausted. He had a bandage on his right temple where a boil had been lanced that afternoon. His nerves were showing, a side of him I had never seen. I asked him if he actually got elected. How would he govern with such a divided mandate? He said he would have to have Democrats in his cabinet. The only one, Norman Mineta, became Secretary of Transportation. As for the Florida recount then underway, the sons of bitches are trying to steal the election. If they try it, there are a lot of other states we could contest. He added, we could explode the entire electoral process if we wanted to, but we're not going to let that happen to this country. As for a possible reconciliation with Gore, I don't want to talk to the man. He's no gentleman. He took back his word. He called me in the middle of the night to concede. Then he calls me back 10-20 minutes later to unconcede. He stared at the floor, eyes wide in disbelief. The next day I was on a panel at the festival, and afterward, as I was walking out of the Capitol to the book signing tent, I came upon several hundred Gore supporters facing off with an equivalent number of Bush supporters only a few feet away, separated by several dozen state troopers. Both sides were waving signs and shouting slogans. It was very ritualized. Bush has won, the people have spoken, one side chanted, and the other responded, recount the vote. There was a kabuki quality to the demonstration, at once theatrical and safe, representing the sharp division of the country but also its democratic restraints. Somehow it made me feel especially patriotic. I remarked to one of the troopers, isn't this great? He grinned and said, it's just wonderful. Gore demanded a recount in precincts where he had done well. An immediate recount of all the ballots cast in the state via voting machines lowered Bush's lead to 327, with absentee ballots yet to be tabulated and a mass of ballots that were difficult to decipher. For 36 days, the country was hypnotized by the intense partisan struggle underway in Florida, having to do with undercounts, butterfly ballots, and hanging pregnant or dimpled chads, the bits of paper that hadn't been cleanly punched out. Nearly 3% of Florida voters, 174,000 of them, had bungled their vote. At one point, Bush's lead dropped to 286 votes. Cheney had a heart attack. Under the Constitution, the issue had to be resolved before December 12th. When the electors would meet, or the election would be thrown into the House of Representatives. On December 11th, the U.S. Supreme Court met to hear arguments by both sides, and at 10 p.m., in a 5-4 decision, the court brought the recount to an end. Bush would be the nation's 43rd president. Many Democrats still believe that the court overturned the will of the people, arguing that Gore won the popular vote nationally and might have won Florida if the recount he had sought had been allowed to proceed. Later, a consortium of newspapers did recount all the ballots. Paradoxically, under the restrictions that Gore had requested, Bush would have won by an even wider margin. And if the recount had followed the procedure demanded by Bush's team, Gore would have won. If every vote in Florida had been counted, Gore would have won under some scenarios. All dimpled or hanging chads were accepted. And Bush under others, a vote counted only when cleanly punched or when the chad was detached on at least two corners. The ambiguity was maddening. We entertained friends from Massachusetts who were horrified that we would even speak to the Bushes after what they had done. Rather you should spit on their shoes and say, sir, how dare you, the red-faced husband said. I admitted that we actually liked the family. Surely not the mother, he cried. The mood at the annual Christmas party at the mansion was completely different from that of the party only a month before during the book festival. I had a chat with Bush, who had met with President Clinton and Vice President Gore earlier that day. He said he had told Clinton that Gore made a mistake by not enlisting the president more in the campaign. Yeah, we're still trying to figure Al out, Clinton said. Bush thought there wasn't much allegiance or affection between the two men. Clinton, he said, didn't seem to mind my being president. As for his meeting with Gore, he acknowledged it was brief. Yeah, 16 minutes, he said. What could you say? The man's not much of a conversationalist. Bush was cheerful and relaxed, bouncing on his toes. A mutual friend of ours, Grant Thomas, who had been at Harvard the same time as Bush, walked in, and the president-elect grabbed him by the back of his neck and cried, Grant, can you believe this? I'm the president of the whole fucking United States! Chapter 6. Turn the radio on. One can drive across Texas and be in two different states at the same time. AM Texas and FM Texas. FM Texas is the silky voice of city dwellers in the kingdom of NPR. It is progressive, blue, reasonable, secular, and smug, almost like California. AM Texas speaks to the suburbs and the rural areas, Trumpland. Its endless bluster and endless ads, paranoia and piety, are the main items on the menu. Alex Jones is Texas's main contribution to this indignant conversation. In addition to his radio program, The Alex Jones Show, he runs an influential website, Infowars.com, a progenitor of the fake news phenomenon. Rolling Stone called Jones the most paranoid man in America. In his hyperbolic imagination, the U.S. government has been behind nearly every disaster imaginable, including 9/11, an inside job, the Oklahoma City bombing, a false flag operation, and the Sandy Hook massacre, a giant hoax. As for Hillary Clinton, one of the most powerful criminal kingpins in history, Jones alleges that she has personally murdered and chopped up children. I met Jones in 2009, when filmmaker Richard Linklater invited me to a screening of American Prince, a documentary by Tommy Pallotta. Rick has always been drawn to alternative ways of thinking, like an anthropologist studying vision quests among Plains Indians. He cast Jones as a street-corner prophet with a bullhorn in A Scanner Darkly, a rotoscoped realization of Philip K. Dick's dystopian novel. Jones played a similar role in a previous Linklater film, Waking Life. I had only a dim idea who Jones was at the time. He had grown up in a suburb outside Dallas and moved to Austin. His defining moment was the siege by the U.S. government of the Branch Davidian compound in Waco in 1993. After that, he became an apostle of the extreme libertarian anti-government movement. Rick impishly introduced us and then stood back with his arms crossed and a delighted expression on his face. Jones has a chunky build and a graveled voice and probing eyes. He knew about my book on Al-Qaeda, The Looming Tower, although I didn't have the impression that he had read it or anything much on the subject. He ventured the opinion that American forces were sending assassination squads into Middle Eastern countries to take out the top guys in Al-Qaeda. I responded that a good source of mine, Jamal Khalifa, who is Osama bin Laden's brother-in-law, had been murdered in Madagascar, I believe by American special forces. At that point, I suppose we were in agreement. I found him pleasant and curious, playful in a way. And yet, Jones's bizarre assertions about 9/11 were already shouldering their way into the popular culture. He claims credit for founding the 9/11 truth movement, which in its most robust version goes like this. The U.S. government, in league with Israel, knew that Al-Qaeda was going to strike America, but the terrorist group wasn't capable of pulling off such an ambitious plan by itself. To ensure the success of the attack, American operatives placed high explosives in the towers, which detonated after the plane struck, creating a controlled bombing to bring the buildings down. Moreover, the Pentagon wasn't actually struck by American Airlines Flight 77. It was hit by an American missile. As for the heroic actions of the passengers on the last of the hijacked planes, United Flight 93, who thwarted the attack on the White House, the truthers assert that the plane was either shot down by a U.S. military jet or secretly landed safely. All this was done to provide an excuse to invade Iraq and steal the oil. There is something mesmerizing about Jones's ability to rant. He reminds me of the televangelist Jimmy Swaggart, whom I once interviewed. Like Swaggart, Jones lives in a world of revelation, convincing himself of the truth of whatever comes out of his mouth. He may also be a performance artist, as Jones's lawyer recently claimed in a custody battle with his former wife, but that suggests he doesn't really believe what he's saying, that he's only talking for effect. Rick later told me that about a week after 9/11, when he and Jones were walking to a screening of Waking Life, Jones admitted that the U.S. government wasn't actually responsible for 9/11, but they're going to use this for all kinds of horrible stuff. He was right about that, Rick observed, but that kind of insight isn't easily monetized. Jones claims a long history in Texas, saying that his great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was at Gonzales, the site of the famous cannon that inspired the come-and-take-it flag. Jones made a speech in front of the Alamo in 2013, with a Gonzales flag flying behind him and a semi-automatic weapon slung over his shoulder. According to Jones, the central message his great-great-great-great-great-grandfather wanted to deliver to the Mexican forces was, "We're not turning our guns in, and we're not running, and we're not backing down. If you want them, come and take them." After the speech, he and the camera crew wandered over to sport with a small counter-demonstration in favor of gun control. There's a video of an older woman asking Jones to leave. She says that she wasn't trying to take his guns away from him. "Santa Anna wanted the guns," Jones says as the woman starts to walk off. But then the woman's husband, an older bald man in a sweater vest, steps in front of Jones. "A gun grab is something nobody in this country wants," he says. "Well, sir, all I can say is you're really getting in my space," Jones responds. They are actually standing very close together. "Why don't you back up?" the man says. "No, I'm not going to back up," Jones moves in closer, chest to chest. "Listen, I don't want to beat an old guy up, so don't touch me." "This guy could take you out in a heartbeat, dear," the wife warns Jones. Jones wisely steps back. While the husband continues to engage with Jones, his exasperated wife tells him, "Sweetheart, you're giving them what they want." There's obviously something deeper going on between the couple. The husband clings to her wrist, but he can't tear himself away from Jones. "Do you know that assault rifles are only used in 2% of crimes?" Jones asks. "I know that an assault rifle was used to murder my daughter in Aurora," the husband says. Jones jumps back. "I didn't touch your daughter," he cries. Jones had called the 2012 Batman shooting, in which 12 people were killed and 70 injured, in a movie theater in the Denver suburb of Aurora, a false flag mind control event. He contends that the movie itself was a weaponized propaganda warfare system with subliminal messages designed to make people frightened of terrorism, so that Bloomberg, Chucky Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, and the usual suspects could push for gun control. Similar Jones rants about mass tragedies being staged by the government have generated death threats for parents of the children murdered at Sandy Hook Elementary School. Another Jones acolyte walked into Comet Ping Pong, a family-oriented pizza parlor in Washington, D.C., in December 2016, and fired a semi-automatic weapon, saying he was there to investigate the claims made by Jones that the restaurant was the center of a child pornography ring led by John Podesta, Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman. Jones eventually apologized for that incident, apparently under legal pressure, but he rarely accepts responsibility for the damage done to the reputation and lives of people he has slandered. In the summer of 2015, when the U.S. Army announced its intention to conduct a massive 8-week training exercise called Jade Helm, ranging across 7 states, Jones floated the news that the federal government was planning to occupy Texas and impose martial law. Walmarts were being converted into concentration camps. Bluebell ice cream trucks would become mobile morgues. "This is an invasion," he claimed, "in preparation for the financial collapse and maybe even Obama not leaving office." Instead of switching stations, Governor Greg Abbott hurriedly called out the Texas State Guard to monitor the exercise. Yes, we have our own state militia, just in case. Jones's fantasies caught the ear of Donald Trump when he started suggesting that Hillary Clinton belonged in prison. That became a mantra in the Trump presidential campaign, as did Jones's allegation that President Obama and Hillary Clinton founded ISIS and that she was being kept alive only by drugs. It is surreal to talk about issues here on air and then word for word hear Trump say it 2 days later, Jones marveled. On another occasion, he remarked, "We're like synced. There isn't any wires in our ears, literally, to each other." Trump himself told Jones on his show, "Your reputation is amazing. I will not let you down. You will be very, very impressed, I hope, and I think we will be speaking a lot." The AM political agenda completed its takeover of Texas politics in 2014 when Dan Patrick, a drive-time radio talk show host from Houston, was elected lieutenant governor. He had a knack for shameless self-promotion, getting a vasectomy on the air, for instance. My friend Mimi Swartz, a journalist in Houston, wrote in Texas Monthly about being on a panel with Patrick in 2003 to interview candidates to be mayor of Houston. "He could not have been more polite or solicitous," Mimi wrote of Patrick. "Just as the program started, he turned to me and casually suggested the following. 'Let me see your questions to make sure we don't duplicate each other.' He then proceeded to ask all her questions himself, leaving me to scramble," Mimi recalled, "dumbfounded in search of new ones as I simultaneously tried to figure out what kind of person was sitting next to me." Patrick was first elected to the Texas Senate in 2006, running as an outsider. "It was as if Rush Limbaugh were running," Bill Miller, a prominent lobbyist in Austin, told me. Patrick crushed three well-known candidates in the Republican primary and won the general election with nearly 70% of the vote. Talented and relentless, Patrick brought with him the expected AM platform of anti-abortion absolutism and hostility to same-sex marriage and illegal immigration. When he was first elected, he was treated as a pariah in the Senate, Miller said. Everyone thought he was going to be a crazy man. But he won respect through his service on the Education Committee, eventually serving as its chairman. "He was recognized for his artfulness," says Miller. In 2014, Patrick beat the incumbent Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst in the primary and then rolled into office atop another Republican tidal wave. Evan Smith, the co-founder of the Texas Tribune, an online journal of state politics, said of Patrick, "He's the most conservative person ever elected to statewide office in the history of Texas." FM and AM Texas rarely talk to each other. But in September 2015, after the shooting of a police officer in Houston by a former mental patient, Patrick appeared on an NPR station in Austin. Patrick had urged Texans to be always respectful of peace officers and to thoughtfully pick up their tabs when they see them in restaurants. David Brown, the urbane host of Texas Standard, gently pointed out that there had been a substantial backlash online to Patrick's statement. Videos of police abuse and the shooting of unarmed citizens were generating national concern about police behavior. Even people who don't engage in reckless rhetoric have said things like, "Look, respect has to be earned," Brown said. "There's a lot of skepticism out there. How do you convince those people?" "You know, your type of interview has to stop," Patrick abruptly replied. "When I was asked to do an interview on NPR, I asked myself, do I really want to do this? They're not in the police officer's corner, and you've proven that by your interview." Patrick declined several opportunities to speak with me. Patrick's signature accomplishment has been the passage of laws allowing certified license holders to openly carry weapons and also to carry concealed weapons on public college campuses. He told Chuck Todd on Meet the Press that the fear that guns in public places would create undue alarm was just propaganda by those who either don't like guns or who are afraid of guns. The lieutenant governor's statement made me recall an incident on May 11, 2013, when Steve Harrigan and I were in Dallas for a literary event, along with our wives and Steve's daughter, Charlotte. We decided to visit the George W. Bush Library on the campus of Southern Methodist University. It was less than a month after the Boston Marathon bombing and the day before a mass shooting at a Mother's Day parade in New Orleans. We were lined up with a large crowd in the vast marble atrium called Freedom Hall, waiting to enter the exhibitions when someone cried out, "Active shooter!" Everyone in the room did exactly the wrong thing. We all hit the deck. An old man near me fell. I saw his head bounce on the marble floor. We were trapped inside a stone box, totally exposed. The library was locked down. Out of nowhere, two campus cops appeared with automatic weapons. A private security guard crept behind the ticket booth with his unholstered pistol. People were openly weeping. Roberta was hunched between two evangelical women who whispered urgent prayers into her ears. "I knew this would happen," Steve's daughter said, giving voice to the lack of surprise we felt to be caught in yet another tragedy of the sort that we've all read about and watched on TV. As it turned out, the event in Dallas was nothing. A black child had been playing outside with a toy gun, which his parents had purchased earlier at the Texas Ranger Museum. Like all toy weapons these days, it had an orange tip to clearly distinguish it from the real thing. The boy needed to go inside to the bathroom, so he gave his toy to his father, who was on a park bench smoking. Suddenly, there was a black man with a gun. The cops put him on the ground and handcuffed him, then questioned him for 2 hours before letting him go. The panic that we experienced that day was unwarranted, but it underscored the fact that the open display of weapons is unnerving, even in Texas, and perhaps especially on college campuses. The age of mass shootings in public spaces actually began on a campus in Texas on August 1, 1966, when Charles Whitman, a 25-year-old engineering student, Eagle Scout, and former Marine, murdered his mother and his wife, then barricaded himself in the top of the landmark tower in the heart of the University of Texas in Austin. He had a duffel bag full of weapons and a clear view of the entire low-slung town. He could see the narrow lake that divides Austin into north and south. To the west was the Balcones Fault, where the hill country begins, and to the east, the flat coastal plain. When Whitman pulled the trigger and changed America, the giant clock above him showed that it was 11:48 a.m. For the next 96 minutes, Whitman fired on the campus and the adjacent shops along Guadalupe Street. The first person he shot was Claire Wilson James, a classmate of mine from Woodrow Wilson High School in Dallas. Claire was in summer school. She was 8 months pregnant, and Whitman apparently aimed at her unborn child, who was the first to die. Claire lay on the blistering pavement, her abdomen ripped open, pretending to be dead. Her boyfriend, Thomas Ekman, fell dead beside her, shot through the neck. Whitman would shoot 43 people from the tower that day, killing 14. A 15th victim eventually succumbed in 2001 from complications from the injury to his kidney. The plaza in front of the tower where Claire lay with her dead boyfriend was about half the size of a football field, totally exposed. You can't imagine how hot the pavement is in August. As she lay there, believing that this was how her life would end, a red-headed co-ed named Rita Jones, later Rita Star Pattern, a visual artist, suddenly ran out to her and asked how she might help. Claire told her to run or she'd get shot. Instead, Rita lay beside her on the blistering concrete, peppering Claire with personal questions about what classes she was taking and where she grew up, keeping her from sinking into unconsciousness. Finally, about an hour into the siege, two daring 17-year-old boys raced out and dragged Claire to safety behind a statue of Jefferson Davis. Within minutes of Whitman's sniper attack, students and citizens began firing back. There were deer rifles in the dormitories and pistols in purses and glove compartments. Armed vigilantes crouched behind statues of Confederate heroes or took aim behind the narrow shelter of a telephone pole. There was a mood of insanity, of wildness, of craziness in the air, one of the students later recalled. There were no SWAT teams back then, although the improvisatory police response to the tower shooting would immediately make the case for them. Nor did the university even have a police force of its own. An Austin cop named Houston McCoy, one of the first responders, had a shotgun, which was useless at a distance. So he drove a student to his apartment to pick up his rifle, and then stopped at a hardware store to buy ammunition. There was practically no direction from police headquarters. This kind of thing was completely new. An innovative police sharpshooter tried to shoot Whitman from a private plane. Meantime, three police officers and a civilian deputized on the spot climbed to the top of the tower, stepping over the bodies of people Whitman had slain on his way up. AM Texas and FM Texas drew opposing lessons from the UT shooting. Claire James would later testify before the Texas legislature that the return fire impeded her rescue and prevented police from taking effective action. The courageous Austin police officers who ascended to the top of the tower did have to dodge the incoming fusillade, which showered them with dust and bits of limestone as they crept along the observation deck. On the other hand, gun proponents argued that by keeping Whitman pinned down, the vigilantes reduced the number of casualties by forcing him to shoot through rainwater spouts. Before anybody fired at him, he had the run of the place. He could shoot over the walls and he could find targets. Ray Martinez, one of the cops who finally shot Whitman to death, recalled, "But of course, I was concerned I was going to get killed by friendly fire when we were up there." The law didn't change after that. It remained illegal for Texans to carry guns outside their home or vehicle. Then, in 1991, George Hennard, who was 35 and unemployed, drove his blue Ford pickup through the plate glass window of the Luby's cafeteria in Killeen. There were about 150 people having lunch. At first, they thought it was a freakish accident. A veterinarian in the room rushed to assist Hennard, who shot him, and then cried, "It's payback time, Bell County. I hope y'all enjoy this." Susanna Hupp, a chiropractor, was having lunch with her parents. "My father and I got down on the floor and we put the table in front of us," she later testified before the U.S. Congress. "It took me a good 45 seconds to realize this man wasn't there to commit a robbery. He wasn't there for a hit. He was there to shoot as many people as he possibly could." She reached for her purse where she kept her pistol, then realized that she had left her gun in her car, fearing that she might lose her chiropractor's license if she were caught carrying a concealed weapon. Her father bravely rushed the shooter, but he was quickly shot down. Hupp told her mother that they needed to make a break for it, and then she raced to the back of the building and jumped out a window. When she looked back, she realized her mother had gone to comfort her dying husband. Hennard put a bullet in her head. "All women of Killeen and Belton are vipers," he cried. He shot 50 people, killing 23 of them, most of them women, before killing himself. "I'm not really mad at the guy who did this," Hupp told lawmakers in Washington. "That's like being mad at a rabid dog." She continued, "I'm mad at my legislators for legislating me out of the right to protect me and my family." In 1996, Hupp got elected to the Texas House of Representatives and subsequently passed a law allowing concealed weapons. It was signed by then-Governor George W. Bush. That wasn't sufficient for the gun lobby, however. They wanted Texans to have the right to openly carry their handguns, as was already legal in 44 other states. When framed that way, it did seem odd that Texas gun laws were more restrictive than those in most other places. But did we really want gunslingers in our restaurants and theaters? Gun advocates in Texas set people on edge by parading down Congress Avenue in front of the state capitol, carrying their long guns, as was legal, or walking into Target stores, which they selected for symbolic purposes. Polls showed that 2/3 of Texans opposed the measure, as did a large majority of the police chiefs in the state, but their complaints didn't register. Open carry became legal on January 1, 2016. It's rare to see anyone in public strapping a sidearm, but everywhere you look on public buildings, you see signs in English and Spanish barring weapons, both openly carried and concealed. Punitive lawmakers required the font of the lengthy text to be an inch high. Scientific measurements were taken showing that, when stacked on top of each other, the two signs were the height of a pony. The statistics on crime and guns are often confounding. Nationally, guns account for 60% of all homicides, and yet gun violence has been declining for the last decade. The murder rate in Texas has dropped from 16.9 per 100,000 in 1980 to 4.8 in 2015, an astonishing decline. In California, the most restrictive state in the country for gun ownership, the murder rate is exactly the same as in Texas. The states with the lowest homicide rates are North Dakota and Wyoming, which have very permissive gun laws, and lowest of all, at 1.6 per 100,000, is Vermont, which has constitutional carry. In other words, anyone over the age of 16 can carry a gun. Vermont is one of 13 states where permits to carry concealed weapons are not required. Chicago, which has highly restrictive gun laws, also has one of the highest rates of gun homicides in the country, but it doesn't compare with the District of Columbia, which tops the charts in both restrictive gun laws and gun homicides. When President Obama said, states with the most gun laws tend to have the fewest gun deaths, he was including suicides, which account for nearly two-thirds of gun deaths nationally. Still, the rate of murder by gun in the United States is far above that of any other developed Western country, and has been increasing since 2015. The rate of gun murders in the United States is 6 times higher than in Canada, and more than 20 times higher than in Australia. Although I appreciate the efforts of the anti-gun lobby, I doubt there is room for anything other than modest reforms. The NRA has permanently changed America. There are now more than 300 million guns in the country, 42% of the total of civilian firearms in the whole world. Other countries with a high rate of gun ownership, though nowhere near as high as the United States, such as Switzerland, Sweden, and France, have lower rates of gun deaths, largely because of more stringent licensing rules and an emphasis on gun safety. Universal background checks that keep guns away from violent offenders, people on the terrorist watch list, and the mentally ill are the most important steps we could take to limit the damage that guns do to our society. In November 2017, 26 people were shot to death at the First Baptist Church in Sutherland Springs, Texas. Another 20 were injured. 8 of those killed were children. It was, at this writing, the deadliest mass shooting in Texas history. These days, it seems that the killers are always aiming for the record books. In this case, the killer had once escaped from a psychiatric hospital. He had been court-martialed for domestic abuse by the Air Force, which then failed to put his name in the FBI's database, which might have prevented him from buying weapons over the counter. He was flagged again and again for abusive behavior and death threats. It's hard to imagine a more glaring example of the failure of our national gun laws to prevent a dangerous man from breaking the hearts of so many innocent people. However, we now live inside the logic that the NRA has created for us. In a world where so many bad people have guns, good people must arm themselves. When the killer came out of the church, leaving behind a lake of blood, a neighbor, Stephen Williford, who happened to have been a former firearms instructor for the NRA, ran barefoot out of his house carrying a similar assault-style weapon. He shot the killer twice and then pursued him in a high-speed chase that ended with the killer's suicide. President Trump, who was in South Korea at the time, was asked whether the extreme vetting he demanded for visa applicants should also be applied to gun purchases. He replied that it would have made no difference in the murders in Sutherland Springs, except that stricter laws might have prevented Williford from having the means to respond. Instead of having 26 dead, he would have had hundreds more dead, the president said. Shortly after the killings, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton said on Fox News that the best solution to future church killings was to arm the parishioners. Even if stricter gun laws in Texas were clearly shown to make us safer, Texas politicians are so enchanted by guns that there's no chance of that happening. There's a locker room lust for weaponry that belies the noble-sounding proclamations about self-protection and Second Amendment rights. In 2010, Governor Rick Perry boasted of killing a coyote that was menacing his daughter's Labrador. Perry was jogging at the time, but naturally he was packing heat, a Ruger 380, and he dispatched the coyote with a single shot. The gun's manufacturer promptly issued a coyote special edition of the gun, which comes in a box labeled "For Sale to Texans Only." The idea of jogging with a gun may sound uncomfortable and a little bizarre, but in this category, Perry is not as goofy as Ted Cruz. In the midst of his presidential campaign, Cruz posted a YouTube video titled "Making Machine Gun Bacon with Ted Cruz." "There are few things I enjoy more than on weekends cooking breakfast with the family," he informs us as he stands at a firing range. "Of course, in Texas, we cook bacon a little differently than most folks." He wraps a strip of bacon around the muzzle of a semi-automatic AR-15, not an actual machine gun, and around that a piece of foil. Then he fires away. Soon grease is spattering among the shell casings. "Mm-mm. Machine gun bacon," the senator says as he snacks on the finished product. The object of the video apparently was to show a jollier and more human side of the candidate. With more than 1 million Texans licensed to carry handguns, the state is actually far behind Florida with 1.7 million. "I'm embarrassed," Governor Greg Abbott tweeted in 2015. "Texas number two in nation for new gun purchases behind California? Let's pick up the pace, Texans," at NRA. On June 13, 2015, a gunman assaulted police headquarters in Dallas in an armored van that he had purchased on eBay. It was billed as a zombie apocalypse assault vehicle and came equipped with gun ports and bulletproof windows. Police were finally able to disable the vehicle and kill the shooter with a 50-caliber sniper rifle, also available on the Internet. Governor Abbott discounted the event as an isolated incident by someone who had serious mental challenges as well as a possible criminal background, without remarking that those alarming deficiencies had not prevented the shooter from purchasing powerful weapons. That same day, Governor Abbott went to a gun range in Pflugerville, outside Austin, and signed into law the bill requiring public universities and colleges to allow handguns on campus and in dorms. He did this despite the vehement opposition from the chancellor of the University of Texas system, William McRaven, the former Navy admiral, who, as head of the United States Special Operations Command, had overseen the operation that killed Osama bin Laden. The bill went into effect on August 1, 2016, exactly 50 years after the Whitman shooting. When the students returned for the fall semester, a protest group called Cox, Not Glocks, handed out more than 4,500 dildos. Some of them were huge and I think possibly lethal. There was a dildo juggling contest and T-shirts emblazoned with the slogan, "Take it and come." Although there is a policy at the university forbidding the public display of any image that is obscene, the administration sagely chose to let this issue reside in the domain of free speech. Supporters of the protest were tying the sex toys onto their backpacks, and others were planting them in the shade of the campus live oaks, where they looked like a forest of mushrooms after a heavy rain. An eccentric feature of the new gun laws is that people entering the state capitol can skip the long lines of tourists waiting to pass through the metal detectors if they show the guards a license to carry permit. In other words, the people most likely to bring weapons into the building aren't scanned at all. Many of the people who breeze through are lawmakers or staffers who actually do tote concealed weapons into the offices and onto the floor of the legislature. but some lobbyists and reporters have also obtained gun licenses just to skirt the lines. I'm one of those people. In the spring of 2016, I signed up to take a class at Central Texas Gun Works that would qualify me to carry a weapon. There were about 30 people in the class, including 6 women. Most of the day was spent learning the Texas General Firearms Law.